his paths, maybe we aren't, leads directly to sort of the second topic that David begins to pray through, which is prayer for forgiveness. Remember, verse 6, remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been of old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me. For the sake of your goodness, O Lord. The prayer for forgiveness. We own that, right? David does. He owns his failures. He owns his mistakes. I cannot tell you the number of times, and maybe you'll relate to this, and I have conversations with people, and it can say messed up on their forehead. You can give them a beer, and they'll say, it doesn't. Nope, it does not say that. And I'll find some way of arguing why it doesn't say messed up on the forehead. Dude, that's me too. I don't think any of us are unique. I think we all fight to deny that we have messed up our forehead. David, the king of Israel, says, God, I need forgiveness. I need to be forgiven. Don't remember that. Don't remember what I did. Remember, this is what's cool, remember who you are. And I love this because what his plea is on what? God's steadfast love. We've talked about this Hebrew word before. Don't remember my sin. Choose to push that aside. And instead, what I want you to remember, God, is the fact that you are a God who pursues broken people. People that need help. That's steadfast love. Pursuing, never stopping, running you down kind of love. Steadfast love isn't like a cushy-bushy, sort of Santa Claus love. Steadfast love is the kind of love that a parent holds their kid's face to the ground if they've got a pin in their ear while the doctor digs it out. That's the kind of steadfast love that pursues and chases us for our own good, even if we don't know it. And that's what David says, God, remember that. Keep that in your mind and hunt me down because I need it. And he says, for the sake of your goodness. God, if you abandon me, a sinner, then you're denying your own goodness. There is hope in that for you and me who struggle. We can, instead of saying, and we do this, God, don't abandon me. You love me, right? I love you. Instead of saying that, we can say, God, don't abandon me because you're good and you're loving and you pursue people like me. So don't abandon me. That's the root of his cry. And it came to be ours. And then quickly he turns to a prayer for guidance. That's what we could call it. Good and upright is the Lord. Verse 8, therefore he instructs sinners in the way, he leads the humble in what is right, and teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimonies, or his witnesses. For your name's sake, O Lord, there it is again, for your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt for his grave. Who is the man who fears the Lord? Him will he instruct in the way that he should choose. His soul shall abide in well-being, and his offspring shall inherit the land. The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant. My eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. This is about guidance. Now, hear this. One of the things that we see right away in this, we move from a recognition of offense, right? That was where we went. Okay, I know I need to be walking in God's paths. I recognize that reality. I recognize that I've often messed up and not walked in. God, forgive me, restore me. And now it's a prayer for guidance. And I love this. It says, he instructs sinners in the way, he leads the humble in what is right. Sinners who own and recognize their sin, what do they become? Even right there in those two verses, they become humble. This is the biggest complaint against the Christian community in America, is that we know everything, that we are know-it-alls, that we are always right, and everybody else has lived their lives. Now, I don't know, but I think if we learned to develop this sort of humility, that basically, where does this come from? By right here, the first sins that we notice are not out there. They're in here. That's what happened in the psalm. David didn't start praying and say, God, save those bad people out there. He started praying and said, God, save me. And it led to humility. I think that leads us all to humility when we begin to recognize just how much we need God's mercy ourselves. I think that's an important point, and we can kind of see this coming through. And it says, all the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness. Now, I looked up that word faithfulness because I'm like, well, that's a little ambiguous to me. I don't know if this is you or not, but faithfulness, right? I just thought somebody, Dan, came. Nick, in fact, he hung some gates. I can feel a day. He hung some gates for me that I, you know, a little beyond my ability, or maybe a lot, he probably argued. But he told me this morning, he said, do me a favor, buy a level. Because he was using the post that I had hung up on. But that's a really good way to understand faithfulness. My post was not faithful. It was not true. It was not reliable. That's what faithfulness is. Truth, reliability, something you can hang a gate on and know that it's going to swing right. That's what faithfulness is. That's the path of the Lord. It's true, reliable, and trustworthy. The path that is offered to us from a number of other places, I promise you, will let you down every time. It won't provide whatever it promises to. So whenever you hear that ancient question, did God really say, like Adam and Eve, you're headed for a fall? And then it says, the path of the Lord, steadfast love, and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant. It doesn't say for those who pray for prayer once. It doesn't say for those who vote right. It doesn't say for those who dress right. He says for those who keep his covenant. Now, covenant, that's a big word, and it's one we'll be doing a sermon series on in the fall. Still working out the details of that. But in short, sometimes we call marriage a covenant, right? Marriage covenant, you heard that? Why do we do that? Because each person makes promises to one another. Now, a man who marries a woman, well, up here, this is what happens. A man who marries a woman, and then, you know, on his honeymoon, he meets another woman, right? Is he keeping the covenant that he made? Even 20 years later, 30 years, it doesn't matter when it happens. He's not keeping his covenant. So when we commit to Christ, and we say, I will walk with you, are we, and we just don't, are we keeping our covenant? Now the good news is, no, we're not. Jesus helps us along the way. But the key to this all is we need to be strugglers. We don't need to be people to rest in a vote or a prayer or a tie or some other thing that proves that we're good enough. Keeping this covenant is partly a recognition that we can't, and we're going to continue to try to do that. I'm not walking on your path, God. Forgive me. Let me walk in your path. A daily repetition of that. Not a weekly, well, I go to church, so I'm a pretty good person. It says, for those who keep his covenant, God's covenant is not show up at church for an hour every week and check it off. That's not the covenant. So if that describes you, please know this verse says the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness, but not for those who simply and merely insist that attending church for an hour every week is good enough for them. I just need to say it because it's right here and you need to know. Now, again, it's for his name's sake. And then we come to verse 15. My eyes are ever toward the Lord. How do we keep this covenant? That's the key. Right there. We see it a few other times in the Bible. You ever heard the phrase, keep your eye on the prize? Most of us have heard that. We focus, whenever we're in a contest, whenever we're in a race, or something difficult that we need to persevere at, we fix our eyes, we envision a marathon runner reminding themselves they got to finish this 26.2 mile thing and focusing on the end, not on mile 18 where it really starts to burn. Fix our eyes on the prize. This goes to Hebrews 12. There's this chapter in Hebrews, chapter 11 of Hebrews. It's really famous. And in it, the writer of Hebrews so sort of repeatedly says, look at this guy, look at that guy, look at that guy, those people, that woman, look at all these faithful people. And he goes throughout history and the Old Testament and even their contemporary era. He says, look at these people who've been faithful to walk with God over these centuries. And even in the face of death and persecution, look at what they've been through. And then he said, he turns and he says, now you. Since you have all those people standing around telling you God is faithful, ultimately, he says, then fix your eyes on Jesus and run. I love that image. That's what David said centuries earlier. My eyes are ever toward the Lord. He didn't look around at other people. He didn't look around at other temptations. Looks, I'm going to look to Christ to save me, to fulfill me, to rescue me, to restore me. That's where my eyes are going to be fixed. How do we do that? I mean, it's hard. In a world where our eyes are fixed on average, I don't even know what it is now, 6 hours a day of video. I mean, we got our 4 on prime time, but then, during work, we have 4 hours of YouTube, right? Those of us that don't drive, I hope. Don't fix our eyes on Jesus. I think one way is, and this is not something we need to make a rule of. You must do this or you're that. No. But one way is to pray psalms. Spend time in the Word of God. Pray through the words. Making them your own. Applying your own story to God's story. What has been said. Fix our eyes on Jesus. We won't run our race. We won't be a covenant keeper with our eyes fixed on a million other places and our hopes hung on a lot of broken nails. And then he goes to trust. Out of all of this, finally the place he comes to is a place of trust. Starting in verse 16, turn to me. And be gracious to me. Listen to the words that he chooses to use to describe himself. For I am lonely and afflicted. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Consider my affliction and my trouble. And forgive all my sins. Consider how many are my foes. With what violent hatred they hate me. Oh, guard my soul and deliver me. Let me not be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. It's a prayer of trust, a prayer that directly comes right out of this humility. And it goes to just a hopefulness. That's all I've got, a hopefulness. When I first read that, one of the things that I again that I thought are, we have this struggle in Christianity between, within our community, and I've heard people tell me, I don't like that you talk about this word I use a lot, brokenness, because I've overcome that. Sort of mentality. I understand that, and it's okay. I mean, we can work through some of those things, but within Christianity, there's sort of two ways that we view, right, who we are. One, we will call triumphalism. The issue of having overcome the broken, being over that, right? We overcome. And that's not entirely wrong. So hear me out. The other is an issue of brokenness. Who are we? Are we those who have overcome, or are we those who are broken? Now, I think, and by broken, I mean lonely, afflicted, distresses, trouble, sinful, all the words that the king of Israel used when he wrote with his own hand the word of God that we just read. Broken or triumphant? Now, here's where that becomes a bit of a problem. If we, and if, hear me out, Jesus is triumphant, okay? Jesus is the king. Jesus defeated evil and will defeat evil finally. Jesus is way triumphant. So we can rest in that. But we also need to remember our own need for that. I'm reminded of the story, some of you heard me talk about this, the Goliath story. So often, the David and Goliath don't know. David, this guy right here, he kills the giant, and this big tall dude comes out every day, and he's like, hey, come on, fight me! He stands there and mocks the people, the soldiers, the whole army of Israel gathered, and they're hiding there. Ditches, you know, laying down and covering their head. They're all praying that God will send somebody out to conquer this powerful foe, right? And then David goes out and does it with a rock to the forehead, kills the giant. Now, often we hear that story and go, what's the giant doing? You're David. What's the giant you need to overcome? Let me tell you something. That is not right. That is not. I know it's a favorite. I know I grew up with it. It's a favorite sort of way to kind of, what's the giant in my life? I'm just like, no. You and I, we are huddled in the ditches praying, God, please send somebody to conquer that giant. And that's Jesus. Jesus is the one who defeats the giant for us. So that's the tension. We need to recognize that we are in the ditch begging for a hero. When I thought of this, I thought of probably the most triumphal Christian song that I can remember, hymn, written years ago. It was actually written, I say it's Christian, it was written as the, it's called the Battle of the Republic. It was written to be a fight song for the Union Army during the Civil War. Listen to some of the lyrics, you'll recognize this. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed his faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Who's truth? Yes. Thank you. I'm just going to read one more quote from it. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel, since God is marching on. It's a very triumphant song. If you know the tune, you got a marching tune going on. It's very overcoming, but every word in it points to the one who overcomes on our behalf. So we are those who are lonely, troubled, and distressed, and afflicted, and we are crying out, help us. And this puts things in the right perspective. Because God doesn't leave us at home. He sends us a hero, Jesus, who ultimately does heal us and promises to conquer every evil that we encounter. So when he says, don't worry, that entirely trustworthy. But right now, she knows that if I've got her, she's going to be okay. So whatever's going on, know that Jesus, and I'm just dad. I mean, you know, that's not that great. But Jesus overcomes, and he's got you. Just think about it. Whatever it is, when he says don't worry, he means it. And then we have an interesting thing that I think points to what praying in Psalms can do for us. And the way this works, because it's an acrostic, as I said earlier, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, every line. And you can even hear it in English. This last line just breaks. And it's not an acrostic. Just says, Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. I find that at the very end, you know, David has hung, he said, okay, I'm going to structure, I'm going to pray through this, and work through a lot of stuff that's going on in here, which is important for us. We need to do that. It's important for him. And he works through it, through this structure, and the final, the very end, just breaks off, and it's a verbal sigh of hope and longing that I think we can all echo. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. Save us. It is both. All of that together is a recognition of our need and his ability to redeem, restore, and rescue every broken part of our lives. Let me pray for us. God, thank you that you are the God who is marching on. Thank you that you have sounded forth the trumpet and shall never call retreat. You are advancing into our broken areas, in our lives, in our community, in our families, in our workplaces, in our church. You are advancing into those broken areas, and you are bringing healing.